Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is John Micklewaith, who is the editor-in-chief of The Economist. His publications, co-authored with Adrian Wooldridge, include The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America, A Future Perfect, The Challenge and Promise of Globalization, and The Company, A Short History of a Revolutionary Idea. John, welcome to Berkeley.
Well, thank you for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in London. I was raised in a place called Rutland, which is the smallest county in Britain.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
It's a worrying question. I think in general ways, in terms of values, in terms of, I suppose, a general approach to life, but neither of them sort of were journalists. My father was a farmer and an army officer, and my mother looked after the house and things. So there wasn't a sort of a bent that would naturally push you towards this. Although I had various grandparents who did sort of various public things.
And so when did you get the journalism bug?
I got it around probably when I was a student, where I was basically a very lazy student. But I did do a couple of articles. I had friends who did newspapers, and so I used to do occasional things for them. And I left Oxford at about the time that Big Bang was underway in the city, which is a time when suddenly the banks in the city of London were suddenly wandering around offering students what seemed at the time huge amounts of money to go and work for them. Now they seem actually incredibly small, but at the time it was a big change in the way that students could live. As I had various friends who applied for BBC internships or went to go and do stuff at The Guardian or The Telegraph or whatever, and I didn't do that. I went into the city for actually no real better reason than the fact that they offered me a job, and I joined Chase Manhattan for a couple of years.
So you started your first immersion in globalization was as a banker.
It was a banker. They promised me the world, and they took me to Hammersmith. That was it. And I actually joined them. It's a true story. I tried to hang on to whatever contacts I had, and I knew an American who worked for J.P. Morgan. So I applied for them, and as a student driving back late one night to Oxford, I had two blinding revelations. One was that in order to buttress my CV for doing J.P. Morgan, I needed to get another American bank. And secondly, I was listening to a David Bowie song called Diamond Dogs, which talks about Manhattan Chase, and that sort of sparked off the thought. So I applied to Chase Manhattan, put very little thought in it, and rather surprisingly, they hired me.
And going back to your education, what did you study at Oxford? Was it
history?
And so that was a fascination that you had, or you?
Yeah, I was always very keen on history. Mm-hmm. I'd loved history even as a boy. Mm-hmm. So you could argue the sort of telling stories or whatever had always stuck there throughout the whole period.
So what did you take from your experience as a banker that segue you into journalism? Anything?
I think what was useful. I was very lucky. I think that's the absolute crucial fact, is I went into banking. I was not a particularly successful banker. I wasn't a complete disaster at it, but I did 2 years, a lot of it with Chase Manhattan training me at alarming expense to themselves. And then at the end of it, I sort of slightly decided that I quite enjoyed banking, but didn't enjoy it that much. And I was very lucky that I had a friend who worked at The Economist who said that they were looking for people. And you have to go back to 1987. It was a very strange period. What was happening at the time was that a lot of people were leaving newspapers and magazines like The Economist. Anyone who had a financial training at the time was worth a lot. So if you were, say, the chemicals correspondent at The Economist, a bank or a stockbroker would come around and say, do you want to be our chemicals analyst? And they would offer you 3 or 4 times your salary. And so they were actually losing people to the city.
I see.
And then you had the slightly bizarre young man, actually there were two of us, both who were actually friends as well, who wanted to come the other way. So I had a sort of rarity value. And the reason why I was lucky was because I joined in August 1987, I'm pretty sure, and in October 1987 there was the stock market crash. And so if I had tried to join after October 1987, it would have been much more difficult. Because firstly, not as many journalists were going to the city. And secondly, a lot of people who were in the city who weren't that happy weren't prepared to go, would have wanted to do journalism.
So it would seem that as an editor of The Economist and somebody who's been a practicing journalist, you covered the United States for The Economist. I'd like to talk a little about what do you see as the skills that make for a good journalist, and how is the nature of journalism changing in this globalized age that you're always talking about? What does it take to do it?
I don't think the basic skills have changed at all in the sense of the sort of desire, two things, you know, the desire to uncover some kind of truth, for lack of, I mean, you don't want to get too pompous about it, but the desire to be able to describe what is going on, that is one part of it, and to do it accurately and fairly. And then the second thing, I think, is the ability to be able to do it in a way that draws people in, to be able to tell the story. You can add other things like, particularly The Economist, we are an opinion-led newspaper, so the ability to be able to come up with opinions that change and people's minds. All those things, I think, are constant. What is different, I don't think, is so much actually globalization. I think it's much more technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the internet. And you can, there's no doubt that to be a good blogger, you have to have some journalistic skills, but not everything. And there are plenty of good journalists who are good bloggers and vice versa. But I think there probably is a different skill, and we're just beginning to sort of see all that.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk some more about that in a second, but help our audience understand. Give us a mission statement for The Economist. What is your ethos? What do you see yourself as offering the world in terms of perspective that others don't do as well?
I think we try and offer we talk about ourselves being a global views paper, which is not a bad description. Global in the sense that we don't carry the flag for any particular country. We are based in Britain, and we certainly have a kind of British voice at times, but we never look at the world through British eyes. We always try and look at it through global eyes. We have the same product worldwide. And that, I think, is, that's mm-hmm. a big thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody else really does that. We additionalized in a tiny way. We have two extra pages in Britain that nobody else gets. Otherwise, it's the same product everywhere, sometimes with a different cover, but it's the same product. So we do take the global thing seriously. The views part of it is actually having, we do have opinions and we put them across. I think that the aim is to be, we were thinking about it the other day, is to be something, a critical insider, if I could put it that way. You want to give people the impression that you've really gone through a lot of things, that you've filtered out, because that's part of our value to people. You've filtered out a lot of the stuff which people don't need to know, and you've tried to push it in on the stuff that they do need to know. We don't have lengthy quotes from people. We try and zero in on stuff. And yet at the same time, to be an independent, critical one, we are beholden to nobody. There's nobody who owns us, nobody who pushes us in a particular direction. We make up our own mind about it, and we will keep doing that.
And your perspective is a classical liberal one, not liberal
so.
In the... Talk a little about that. I mean, it's those values that come out...
I think that's the core of The Economist. When you think about The Economist, you think about... most people tend to think about it in terms of free trade. We were set up to fight the Corn Laws, the main kind of protectionist thing at the time, which incidentally, the abolition of what welcomed the first great age of globalization. So the economic side of liberalism, everybody knows about. The other side of liberalism, the sort of social side of liberalism, was also there from the very beginning. We fought for prison reform, we fought against capital punishment, we fought against slavery. And that has been the way we've kept going ever since. What's interesting about The Economist is we have a message which doesn't actually sing to any particular party, particularly in America. We often agree with the Republicans, well, at least with the Republicans when they're in their small government mode on economic issues. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, what can be more absurd from a classical liberal point of view than the definition of a big government liberal? The word liberal has got hopelessly mixed up in America. But on social issues, we tend to often agree with the Democrats on things like gay marriage, virtually anything to do with the giving individuals freedom over what they do, and also on things like Guantanamo or whatever. Those are issues which we've campaigned on early because we see them as part of the same thing. And so we do have this very strong point of view. It is a liberal point of view. It's a classical liberal point of view. And actually one of the strangest things about America at the moment is I often feel very annoyed and frustrated by the way that the use of the word liberal has got completely hopelessly messed up in America at the moment.
Think liberal, think San Francisco, right?
Yes, again, I mean, San Francisco is, you know, one bit of San Francisco is we would regard as wonderfully liberal, yeah. the kind of social, cultural side of it. The less liberal side is the huge city government. Mm-hmm. That's another issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, your market is global, but interestingly enough, your American market is much larger than the market in Britain, from what I read.
2 million copies every week. And of that, around 600,000, just a bit over, in fact, is in America. And about 170,000 is in Britain.
Hmm.
So you can see from that. And you can see from that also the reason why we don't particularly take a British view on things, because it's a relatively small part of our overall circulation.
Mm-hmm. Help us understand how the economists generate, say, you do a major piece on the environment, say, for
yeah.
example. What is involved in your role as the editor in making that happen, and how does the piece come together?
I think we're still relatively bottom up, to the extent that people come back and they say, I have an idea about something. You know, we're not a large staff. That's the other point about The Economist. You know, 80, depending on how you measure it, say roughly 80 journalists mm-hmm. working there, which for the size of product we produce is actually quite small,
yeah.
certainly compared with a lot of our competitors. From that point of view, the idea that somebody at the top can say, we should definitely write about this, is, I think, limited. There are times where I think something's important, we should go and do it, and I bully or cajole or plead or try and persuade people mm-hmm. to do it. But on the whole, what you want is ideas coming up from the bottom, I think. And the skill of editing, such as it is to decide which ones to push, which ones to put on your cover, which ones to actually say, no, that doesn't really work. It doesn't, you know, you haven't quite persuaded me that, mm-hmm. I don't know, bits to do with global warming, you know, or the other way around, or whichever side of it is. And so the way most of the stuff we've done on the environment over the past year or so has been from the people who write about the environment. My deputy, Emma Duncan's always taken a very strong interest in it. She wrote a big sort of survey or special report on it last year. But that was her going, I mean, we commissioned her to do it, mm-hmm. that, you know, it was her who drove that, and then we pushed things off the back of it. And there are things on the environment we've always said we wanted. We've always said we wanted to have a carbon tax. But we accept that many people don't like that, mm-hmm. not least in the American petroleum industry.
Well, and your global staff is what you said, or is 80 the staff in London?
No, 80 is the global staff,
oh,
roughly.
You can conclude,
and probably within London it's about 50 journalists in London. Then you have groups of people in probably about 15 in America, and the same bit more again around the rest of the world. And what we've tried to do is we have tried to open up offices around the world at slightly the same time as the rest of the media industry have been closing theirs.
Let's go back to this question about technology, because it would seem you're in the forefront in giving us informed views about this process of globalization, the impact of technology. At some point, will technology impact the way you do what you do? I mean, we see it happening in America, the blogs, the video, and so on. Or will your niche be to pretty much stay the way you are?
I think there are two parts of that. Yes, it's obviously already done it. We already have blogs. We have a couple, I think three as of today.
Mm-hmm.
One, we have an economics blog. We have one on American politics, and we now got one, a sort of letters blog, whereby we're printing all the letters that people send in, even though not printing them all, we're putting them all up on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll introduce one, I think, quite soon on Europe. So we do stuff like this. We have daily columns on online content. We have much sort of, one of the things I've tried to do is to bring in a sort of much livelier daily online comment coverage. So every day you're going to get a fresh piece of news analysis up to the same standard as the rest of the paper. You're going to get a column which changes each day. So we have, for example, one on greenery, I think this morning. But tomorrow there'd be one on the art market, the day after there'd be one on politics. And they revolve on a weekly basis. So you have that. You have all those elements. are just ways of making people. We have a foreign correspondence diary, and actually we have a podcast which has done actually amazingly well and shot up to the top of the charts. That all those things are there, and they're things we're trying to do. In terms of, do we think the technological change is going to take away our print franchise? The answer on that is we're paranoidly optimistic about it. To the extent that when I first came in, I talked a great deal about there being a hurricane coming towards our industry. It was going to slam into newspapers. It's transparently done that. And it looks as if it was going to come onto magazines afterwards. For various reasons, actually now, I think the particular thing which The Economist does, the particular breadth of coverage we do and the particular depth of coverage we do, is actually quite difficult to replicate on the internet. And there's also the serendipity of flicking through things. And what we'd worried about was that young people, probably like many of your students, wouldn't want that kind of experience in print. They want to have it online. But actually, we did a lot of research where we never mentioned the word The Economist. We just asked people how they took in information. But once you've got to that type of thing, particularly a weekend read, particularly something taking that degree of breadth, and that degree of depth, there isn't really a kind of net experience that people want to have. And so from that perspective, so far at least, we're relatively optimistic about the print thing. I should add two immediate sort of caveats. One, it could be all the research and stuff we've looked at could turn out to be wrong, so we don't know about that. Secondly, it could turn out that the advertisers do move away from the print towards the web, and that has an impact. But unlike the big answer to the second one of those is that, unlike everybody else, we actually make money out of circulation. So we could survive on circulation alone. We wouldn't be very rich, but we could run a magazine just purely on that.
You were here. You started, I believe, the bureau, your Economist bureau in Los Angeles and other places, and then you covered the country for a while. What's the difference between British and American journalism? American journalism has undergone a lot of criticism after the Iraq War.
I think America flagellates itself slightly too much about that. I've had a lot of questions about that today, actually, wandering around talking to people about newspapers and magazines in particular. I think there's an element in America where people are saying, look, we're in terrible trouble, our newspapers are making mistakes and so on. I think American media, despite some appalling layoffs and things going on, has in some ways never been healthier. You have all these papers, you have the television, and now you've got the media and you've got the online media as well. You put all that together, I think it's a richer, more vibrant set of things than before. I think there are question marks, which apply just as much to Britain as well, is if you are asking a journalist, I'm inventing this person. Mm-hmm. Imagine, for the sake of argument, I work for the Los Angeles Times, and I'm expected, and I have no idea what the Los Angeles Times does specifically requests of journalists, but I'm expected to contribute towards a podcast, to do a bit of a blog, and to cover my beat. Well, there's going to be some element of stretching within that, and so there may be quality things on that. I think on the whole, though, that one of the useful things about blogs and all those things is they are disciplining papers. Mm-hmm. One difference between American and British papers, you can argue in many ways, actually, American papers have generally had a higher standard. They've generally, you know, if you look at things like sourcing and all those type of things, American papers tend to be better in terms of the products they go through. The only thing which I think the British have had, the only advantage they've had over the Americans, is the existence of a magazine called Private Eye, which comes out every 2 weeks and basically ridicules journalists on a regular basis, treats them, and I think actually rather weirdly, it's quite an important thing. In America, if you're a journalist, you are a writer. You are a figure of great authority. In Britain, if you're a journalist, you're a hack. You know, you're the lowest of the low, ridiculed week in, week out by this satirical thing, which points out relentlessly that the only reason why so-and-so wrote about this is because his mother lives there also. And those various, and the various sort of not entirely fulsome lives of journalists are catalogued there. And the reason why, I mean, they'll probably write something about me in the next couple of weeks and I'll resent it deeply, but the reason why that's good, I think, is it takes away some of the sort of self-importance of journalists, which I think journalists are inclined to do.
Let's talk a little about globalism. You've written a book on globalization, which really is offering a very positive perspective on what globalization is achieving for the world and so on. And so let's walk a little through that, because one of the things that I'm curious about is, well, terrorism. Mm. Let's start there. The 9/11 attack and America's response. To what extent has that unraveled some of the possibilities that that were there, or is it just a kind of a temporary setback in terms of what these forces will do?
And the book we wrote on globalization was a bit ago, but I think that, and actually came out, I think, just before the September, before the attacks. I think the basics of the book, I still stand by. The basics of the book was saying, look, globalization is a cruel, uneven process, but it is an amazing thing for the world. It's dragging millions and millions of people out of poverty. But the danger of this economic process, which is good and useful, is that its political constituency is very limited. There are people the losers of globalization are very hard to identify. The losers are very easy to identify, and the winners are often much harder. The shuttered steel plant is easy. All the people who gain by having cheaper steel in the economy are much wider and more diffuse. The big thing, which also we kept on harping back on in that book, which I still do, is the idea that politics... You cannot be an economic determinist about globalization. There's a tendency, and I think particularly in the Bay Area, to pick on the Bay Area, perhaps unfairly, is the tendency to think of, if something has technology behind it, something has economic logic behind it, it will work. You know, it will stay. Mm-hmm. Globalization has both those things behind it, and yet fundamentally politics, nationalism, all those things come into play. A lunatic in a cave in Afghanistan can bring down two biggest buildings in New York and change the world. That there was nothing, you know, everything was against him, and yet fundamentally those kind of almost medieval feelings can come back. And you go back 100 years now, mm-hmm. quite well documented. You go back 100 years to the end of the first stage of globalization. You see people writing similarly optimistic books to the type of ones you see nowadays, but it all went wrong. And Peter Drucker has some statement somewhere along the lines about whenever economic logic and political illogic collide, political illogic eventually, you know, will often win the day. And that is what worries me a great deal. I mean, I think just thinking about it, actually, because you asked me about it, I think one thing which we didn't perhaps focus in enough on that book, which has come out more since, is to do with income inequality. Mm-hmm. The questions about the fact that median wages have basically stagnated whilst people at the top have gone up. There is an incredibly long argument, which I think I won't, probably best not to get into, about whether technology or globalization is to blame for that state of affairs. And roughly speaking, I would probably put much more blame on technology, but that doesn't really matter from a political viewpoint. Because from a political viewpoint, people will blame globalization. Globalization is unpopular. Foreigners making the same goods as you is unpopular. Technology isn't. Technology is seen as progress. And so I think that has, again, added to the levels of problems with it.
And what do you see the way of dealing with this important problem that you've identified, this interface between politics and the economics? Because what we see again and again is the lack of accountability, yeah, on the part of political institutions, the international political institutions, the UN, and so on, but also the inability to come together to solve problems such as trade balances and monetary issues. Talk a little about that.
Well, I think that trade is almost a perfect example. You actually have with trade, you actually have probably one of the better functioning organizations, mm-hmm. in the World Trade Organization, you know, one which actually seems to work in a much better way than say, certain bits of the UN do. And yet, fundamentally, it's still amazingly difficult. And one of the reasons why is because so much politics is still national. You know, it's national things that drive things forward. Look at the French and the Americans arguing about farm subsidies. You know, two very sophisticated groups of people, yet when it comes down to it, they're at each other's throats. And there's a there's a revealing bit in Adam Smith where he talks about how you would feel if you lost. You were two things. One, you were told that there'd been a great earthquake in China, which had, I think, got rid of a myriad of inhabitants, had disappeared. Mm-hmm. So millions of people have died in a great earthquake in China. On the other hand, the pain you would feel if you lost your little finger. Mm-hmm. And his point was simple, was in the end, mm-hmm. you would say how terrible it was about all those people in China, mm-hmm. but you wouldn't care quite enough, whilst your little finger would really hurt you. And what he was trying to say was that all politics fundamentally is local, at least in that sense of it. And that is the reason why. That and a degree of kind of economic, I can't think of what the word is, I mean, economic obstinacy about, you know, the idea that somehow exports are good and imports are bad. I mean, that mm-hmm. doesn't make sense economically, but that's, people get away with it. It's a way in which politicians like to depict things. So I think it is difficult, yes.
So the national identity, the focus on borders, all of the things that we associate with the sovereignty of the nation state still are there. And
very much,
still,
I mean,
are residual problems in the face of all of this.
Look at, I mean, one of the, you know, to use an example, religion or nationalism. But both of them, in a weird way, the same. You know, these are things which people hoped would sort of somehow go away. I mean, you can see there's a lot in the sort of founders of the European Union. Strangely, if you sort of set people free, you can see this in the Eastern Bloc, you can see this in China to some extent. You withdraw these tyrannies. You certainly see it in the Middle East, and you give them democracy. I mean, what do they vote for? They vote for some nationalism part, you know, those kind of emotions come out. They vote for religion often, you know, people flock to churches.
Yeah, and tribe.
And those have an effect. You know, there are these emotions which people, for good or bad reasons, you know, find very, very important. You know, you look at the European Union and you see what's happened on the edges, such as, for example, in Britain, you suddenly see the huge rise in Scottish, well, so a smallish rise in Scottish independence. And quite a big rise in English independence, saying, you know, why the hell have we got these people?
Mm-hmm. So let's take an issue. We mentioned the environment. Let's pick up on that again. Is that a place where we're beginning to see political responses to a problem that is really global, that a problem that to some extent, you know, results from the way multinational corporations have not been regulated enough? Are we beginning to see a solution? That oil company thing you may not agree with.
I think the multinational thing is rubbish, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nothing to do. The reason why we have so much pollution is it's very difficult. You know, multinationals are such a small part of the world economy. It's much more local companies which are doing it, and local, you know, even local farmers who are causing all this pollution. So that it's one of those sort of tired cliches to blame it on multinational companies. It's not really. There are lots of terrible things multinational companies do. The environment, they may not be great on, but it's not really their fault. It's the fault of governments. Governments dealing with it. The interesting question. I think that if you'd asked me 2 years ago, I would have said it's the absolute brilliant example of the kind of tragedy of the commons, mm-hmm. where it's so difficult to get people to do things because they don't think it's in their own interest. I think in a weird way that has changed. Mm-hmm. You know, people have begun to realise, I mean, even last week we saw George Bush suddenly talking about climate change. Mm-hmm. And it's partly to do with the evidence changing. I mean, the economists, we were sceptical about some of the economics of what people were talking about global warming. Science, we've always been slightly more supportive of about the evidence there. But, you know, as evidence mounts, people mm-hmm. change their minds. And I think you can see that in a whole variety of other people. What's interesting now, and I think in some ways it could be the test case, you have America, India, China. No interest at all 2 years ago in having anything to do mm-hmm. with Kyoto. Sure. Nothing really will matter unless America comes on board and India and China come on board. You know, basically, the rest of what the other people are doing in terms of climate change really doesn't amount to much. I was in an argument with someone in Britain the other day where I was saying Britain should adopt a carbon tax or do things like that. And somebody came back quite strongly and not illogically and said, well, you know, what on earth's the point as long as the Americans just blow the stuff up into the air with gay abandon? And the Chinese and the Indians don't even begin to start doing stuff, then really, you know, why should the British impose barriers on themselves if nobody else will move? And there is a sort of logic to that, but I think there is now at least the first signs of change. And I think actually Bush is an interesting figure like that. Bush sees himself as a kind of surprisingly green figure. He doesn't see himself as surprisingly green, but he sees himself as more green than people might imagine. Mm-hmm. He thinks of his ranch as very, very green. His vision of greenery doesn't altogether seem to accommodate extractive industries, it has to be said. But all the same, there is that possibility. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is a chance for a president in his last 2 years to actually seize on something. And he could come up with a different version of something closer to Kyoto, and that could have a real impact on the world.
Mm-hmm. And this, your discussion of America leads to a conversation about your analysis of the American polity. But one of the things that has clearly happened is that our response to 9/11 and other kinds of unilateral actions that we've taken have diminished confidence, you know, in America or at least its political leaders. Mm. So I guess the big question I want to ask you is it, in your view, can globalization work without America? Can it work in a multipolar political context, or what?
I think the guarantor of globalization has been the West, which to some extent is a sort of better, you know, that you would imagine that's a better thing than just having America getting. America definitely the main, you know, pusher behind the West, but the fact that both America and Europe, you know, obviously disagreements about farm subsidies or whatever, but pretty much you've had these, the Transatlantic Alliance has been sitting behind it. It's generally pushed for markets to be opened up. It's generally pushed for freedoms to be opened up. And as I said, that is one of the great beneficial changes of all time. You know, just in China, eight hundred million people dragged out of poverty. That's an incredible thing to have achieved. But the problem with the West at the moment, as I see, is that there are fundamental divisions at the moment in terms of attitudes and things between Europe and America, and those are beginning to play out. And what is difficult is that people tend to look at the moment and say it's just a matter of personalities. If we hadn't had George Bush, we hadn't had Donald Rumsfeld, we hadn't had Jacques Chirac, we hadn't had Gerhard Schroeder, we would not be in this situation. But I think actually it's deeper than that. If you look at, you know, George Bush may exemplify certain American characteristics, but those are characteristics, they're not that odd in terms of America. If you look at, you know, again, drifting into another book, but you know, you look at America is fundamentally a much more conservative place than Europe is, and some of the differences between Europe and America, which were hidden throughout the Cold War, have begun to emerge, and how we deal with that is actually very important.
And so for you, in a way, the notion drawing on the analysis of your book, which I will show, I have it with me, Nation. We still want to sell copies of it. What you're really saying is that really the differences that Bush came to represent between the United States and the rest of the world, that he was in a way more representative of the country and its history and tradition than is given credit, and that you're not going to see drastic changes if Democrats come in.
No, you've already seen some of the in the midterm elections last year. If you look at the Democrats who were elected, they tended to be on the sort of cultural issues, God's gaze, guns. You know, they tended to take a fairly conservative approach on that. From my perspective, they were annoyingly left wing when it came to things like trade and things like that. Mm-hmm. They were not good on that. But in terms of the type of things that this huge conservative movement have fought for, I think in some ways your success as a political movement tends to come when you change the opposition. And I think you could make quite a strong case that if you look at the Democrats at the moment, they are actually putting forward a philosophy which is certainly way to the right of any European conservative party. I mean, if you take John Kerry and you take the British Conservative Party. By any measure, John Kerry has a much more conservative vision of the world than the British Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. And the British Conservative Party is by far the most right-wing out of the main European Conservative
Now, on
parties.
What kind of issues? You mean on America's
I think
role?
On the size. I think on the size of government. Mm-hmm. You know, the Tories would go for a size of government which is considerably bigger than Ted Kennedy's most wildly outlandish visions. On terms of crime and punishment, if you look at the type mm-hmm. of, you know, boasting Kerry did about sending people to prison. I mean, prison's a very good example of just one thing which people have, you know, barely begun to notice. But Bush got all that stuff about being the sort of serial executioner, somebody who sent people to death by standard, which horrified Europeans. In fact, actually, just in general, on crime and punishment, America takes a much, much tougher line than Europe. America sends people to prison at five times the rate that they do in Britain, and Britain is the toughest imprisoner in Europe. So you know, it's another series of differences. There's a fundamental difference, I think, when it comes to government. You know, you look at the polling evidence on this is incredibly clear. You ask Europeans, ask Europeans and Americans the same question. Do you think government is there to be used as a way of empowering you and giving you a chance to go off and make or lose money? Or do you think it's there to be a safety net? Europeans will go by 70-80% for safety net. Americans will go exactly the other way. And I think those are difficult things to handle. And the one we haven't even begun to touch on is, you know, religiosity, patriotism. Again, mm-hmm. the differences between America and Europe are quite big on all those things. So I do think there is, you know, there are issues there to deal with.
And you're really saying in the book that America is a lot about values and not class, and that makes it distinctive, say, in comparison with Europe and its history.
Definitely makes it distinctive in terms of voting. I mean, mm-hmm. what's very interesting, I mean, you know, these are broad generalizations, and mm-hmm. so and people can come up with individual bits which are different, but I think the overall picture is very difficult to disagree with. You know, if you look at the sort of people in most other countries in the world, you know, class matters more than values, not in America. You know, values really matters. We saw that in both the two elections that Bush won. And you know, there are exceptions. There were plenty of kind of working class voters who supported Margaret Thatcher and so on and so on. But it is it's still a fundamental difference, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, and you actually believe that not only because of what America is, will these conflicts with Europe and the rest of the world remain? But you're also suggesting that American power is really unmatched in regard to indicators such as military power, expenditure on research and development, on demography, I think, is another thing that you point out. Our geography, you know, the great expanse. That these are measures that remain high for America, even if things look bad at a particular time.
Yes, I do. I think it's interesting. I think the sort of neoconservatives got it kind of wrong to the extent that they thought that America had this sort of, how can I put it, positive dominance. You know, America could dominate foreign policy, could steer where everything was going to go, and that transfer apparently did not work in Iraq. You know, the friend of mine, Neil Ferguson, his stuff on that is absolutely clear. As an imperial power, America does not have enough troops. Mm-hmm. You know, it hasn't begun to think how to do that. So from that perspective, America, the sort of positive dominant force, it doesn't have as much strength as the neocons thought. On the other hand, as a sort of negative force, America is still, it's very difficult to get anything going in the world without America being involved. Classic example being the environment. You know, America's ability to sort of stop things happening is gigantic. So if you look from over the next 10, 15 years, America is still going to be the dominant power in that sense. Even your most wild expectations about either the European Union or China, who are the only two mm-hmm. real serious things, are not probably really likely to come in over that period. But there are, you know, these things do change over time. But for the moment, at least, in America, it is the strongest one. And as a result, I think you're going to see a slightly different attitude in America than you're going to have elsewhere. Whoever is the strongest power in the world, regardless of how much they may want to rein in that power, does have a role. You end up being the world's policeman. whether you like it or not. You could argue policemen always take a slightly conservative view as a result, but that's the way America is slightly bound to be. Demography also helps. In America, it's got a younger population than Europe has.
You pointed out that your magazine begins at the height of British power and became
single-handedly brought it down.
No, but at least you were there to report it. Let's put it that way. And I guess the question is: do you see a cause of concern when you look at America that our power might become diminished, that we might be the former hegemon in the way Britain does, or and is there anything that we can do about what you see?
I think, well, there's two things. One, you know, you can take a very long-term view, and you can say, I think it was 2040, you can say, well, that's when the Chinese economy would be big as the American one. I think that's too far out to really start sort of worrying or thinking about. In terms of what America can do, I mean, I think there are, the risk of labouring a point, that, you know, there's more that America can do in hearts and minds. I mean, I remember after the Iraq War, the economists supported the Iraq War, but another thing we were very big on very early on is we slammed straight into Guantanamo and said Guantanamo was a disgrace and wrong. And the reason why was, we, regardless of, not only didn't it not transparently not work, we thought it was fundamentally un-American. It didn't stand for any of the things America did. And one of the things America has got to do in its battle with, you know, deeply unpleasant forces, is to sort of sing from the right songbook. It's, you know, it's notable that when you go back to the last big struggle America won with the Cold War, you could point towards human rights as being one of those things where America was conspicuously on the side of the good guys, where you had the Helsinki Agreement and all those type of things. It was a way of attacking the other side. Now you have the ludicrous, I mean, and actually, and I'm not in any way praising this, it's obviously deeply wrong and hypocritical, you have the Chinese daring to ask America about human rights. And once you get in that kind of position, I think the battle for hearts and minds, you know, the damage done by Guantanamo, the damage done by Abu Ghraib, is real and substantial. And if you look at the type of battle that America is now in, it does require those type of things. And so I think that's you know, there is plenty of room to be done in that area, for example.
Your two important works, one on globalization, one on the right nation, lead me to ask you about the interface between the two, basically. In other words, the right nation would support some aspects, you know, of the formula that makes globalization works. But on the other hand, especially on the social issues, for example, it cuts the other way. How do you see that balance coming out so that the right nation in its new guise is an engine for globalization, as the U.S. has been in the past?
I suppose I should make a difference between the two books. I think we'd be, how can I put it, apologists for globalization, but I'm not an apologist for conservative America. They can do their own.
No,
job.
I wasn't saying
it
you
was.
Weren't.
No, but so therefore, it's a sort of difficult one to link the two from my perspective.
Oh, I see.
But I do. I think that it's a very, very interesting point. Nobody's actually asked me that before. But I think the element, there's an element within conservative America which is, you know, well, it's quite isolationist. Doesn't like the idea of this outside world. You can see it on immigration. You can see it Pat Buchanan. You can see it with other bits. And what against that, there's quite a strong sort of business element within it, which tends to want to open things up. The difficulty comes maybe on that conversation we had earlier to do with values. If the West, if the right nation is part of the West fraying a bit, that is bound to harm globalization, I think, to some extent. It's quite difficult, to be fair to Bush, it's quite difficult to fault him on free trade. He made a few stupid things to do with steel when he thought that was a good idea for a brief time. But on the whole, he's tried to fight for free trade, perhaps not as hard as I would want, but, you know, he's a bit... Free trade and immigration, actually, I think Bush has been, from our perspective at least, a relatively good president on, if you've just kept it to those two areas.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about, because it would seem to the pivotal for the future of globalization is this interdependence between China and the West, and especially the U.S., that emerges. Do you see that working its way through to further globalization, or there's a real danger there that it could lead to a kind of unraveling?
I'm worried about that because I think China stirs up problems in America that the obvious thing to compare Sinophobia now with is Japanophobia back in the 1980s. And I was here then, and I remember the levels to which it reached, and I remember the way in which every book was about how the Japanese were going to take over things, often deeply pernicious. And I never really completely bought it. But I think Sinophobia is a much more potent weapon because it doesn't just have economic worries behind it. It's not just people worried about losing their jobs, about Chinese companies coming in and buying things. You've got a whole variety of other people coming in. You've got Christians in America deeply worried about what's happening to Christians in China. Mm-hmm. You have got the national security people who are deeply worried about energy security and things like that. You've got all the neoconservatives who are deeply worried. They've always been deeply worried about China. If you go back to the spy plane incident when Bush first came in, you look at copies of, say, the Weekly Standard back then, you see people denouncing the Bush presidency as over before it's begun because, how could he have given in on this relative thing? Now, Sinophobia, I think, carries a much wider degree of power in America.
But what about the other aspect of this, the interlocking of our financial systems through America's trade deficit and China being willing to acquire dollars and keep them and so on?
China has an enormous amount of dollars, and that could have an effect. Their bank carries gigantic amounts of dollar reserves, and so they could do something. They're slightly stuck. I mean, there's a limit to how much they can do. They may have to cash them in some periods to do with domestic unrest and stuff, which they haven't sort of got around to doing. But my instinct is they're probably not going to do that much on it. They do have the ability, though, to fire back if the Americans get difficult about it. And that, I think, is that's worth quite a lot.
If you issued a paperback with a new appendix of The Right Nation, is there anything that you would change? Personally, I thought it held up pretty well, but I guess the big issue is the consequence of the Iraq War. Or
I think you'd have to. A decent line of attack on the Right Nation is, you said that conservatism was the dominant. The dominant power in America, and you look at the 2006 midterm elections. That's a reasonable line of attack, I think. And my answer to it is one, look at the type of Democrats who got elected. That they were actually relatively conservative. You movements win when they change their opposition. I think a second thing is that if the Republicans had not got beaten in 2006, it's almost impossible to imagine what could have beaten them. I mean, you have that degree of incompetence, ineptitude, the whole kind of corruption of the pork and all that type of stuff. They did stretch it, not just Iraq, there was Katrina, there was a variety of other things. Pretty much the Republicans took it right to the very limits of what you could humanly ever expect to get away with. So I think just purely, America might still be a deeply conservative place and get rid of these people just purely on the basis that they were messing it up so badly. But I think the interesting one, which is somewhere at the back, is whether the 2006 result might help the Republicans in the 2008 presidential, because in two ways. One, which I suspect is probably true, full stop, it's persuaded them that they do need to have some candidates who can appeal to the centre, at least vaguely. If they had somehow managed to get away with it in 2006, I think they would have gone for the right winger and thought they could get away with it, and that might have been well have been disastrous. But secondly, also, I think it's the ability of a kind of party to cleanse itself and push itself back up to vibrancy at the same time as the Democrats now have some degree of power, and so it's going to be more difficult for them to blame the Republicans for things that went wrong.
One final question. If students were watching this interview, how would you advise them to prepare for the future? I know you would tell them to subscribe to The Economist, but what beyond that?
Buy another subscription. Yeah. I think the same skills are sort of broadly there. I think the same, if any people in the world don't need our help, I think it's people at Berkeley. I mean, if you this particular region, you are overflowing in opportunities and possibilities. And I think that's, I think to remain true to those bits to do with California, that's what's so amazing about California. That's what brings people like me back again and again and again, because it has this ability to take very young people, or for young people to come here, come up with amazing ideas which can or cannot change the world. But it's that sense of kind of why not. And I think if they ever lost that, that would be the tragedy.
On that note, and let me show our audience your book again. I'm sure they can still buy it, but it's worth reading in terms of what it's saying about America and its relation to the world. So, John, thank you very much
for joining us.
We hope to have you back on the campus sometime soon.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.